you all very much. Please be seated. Thanks for coming.
First of all, Terry, thanks for the invitation. My purpose is to share with you what's on my mind, and then I look forward to hearing what's on yours. I regret only one thing, Terry, and that's that Laura didn't come with me. Most people generally say, you should have brought her, you should have stayed at home. They love Laura, and so do I. And she is a fantastic first lady. She is a great. She is a great source of comfort and strength for me, and I wish you were here. I want to thank the chamber and the board of directors of the chamber for allowing me to come. You know, as Terry said, I'm the commander-in-chief. I'm also the educator-in-chief, and I have a duty to explain how and why I make decisions, and that's part of the reason I'm here. I want to thank your governor for being here. Joe Manchin is he's a good, decent man. He showed his heart during the mine tragedies. He represented the best of West Virginia. He showed great compassion, great concern. He asked the nation to pray on behalf of the families. We still must continue to pray for those who lost their loved ones. Joe's a problem solver. He said, we're going to deal with this issue head on. And I appreciate you working closely with the federal government to make sure that there's safety regulations that work, that the inspection process works, so that the miners here in this important state are able to do their job and their families can be secure in them doing their job. So, Joe, thank you very much for your leadership. Thanks for bringing Gail. Like you, I married well, too. I appreciate Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito. Thanks for being here. I appreciate working with you. He's a good one, as we say in Texas. Probably shouldn't bring up Texas too much today, given the fact, yeah, I know. Never mind. I'm a little worried for my Longhorns, so I'll tell you that. I'm voting for him. I'm voting for him because he's going to play a fine team. I want to thank the mayor for being here. Mr. Mayor, I'm honored that you're at the airport. I appreciate you coming. Thanks for serving your great community. God bless you, sir. Members of the State House greeted me. I appreciate Senator Mike Oliveira. He's here. Mike, I think, did the country a great service when he worked on behalf of Judge Sam Alito to get him approved by the United States Senate. I appreciate you. Well, thank you for that, Mike. I want to thank him. Mike said, don't hold it against me. I'm a Democrat. I said, Mike, what we're first and foremost, we're all Americans. And I thank Chris Wakeham. He also was out at the airport. It's a little chilly for you all standing out there, but I had your overcoats on. That's all right. Thanks for being here, Chris. Thanks to all the members of the State House and local officials who joined us today. Thank you for serving your state and your community. I want to thank John Anderson and Janice LaFont. They're from the Valley National Gas's employees. They presented me with a check for $100,000 for the Katrina Relief Fund. I want to thank you all for doing that. I want to thank the folks you work with for doing that. It's an amazing country, isn't it, when you think about it? The folks right here in this part of West Virginia care enough about folks in the southern part of our country that they would take some of their hard-earned money and contribute to relief funds so people can get their lives back together. It means a lot to the people in Louisiana and Mississippi to know that there is love and compassion for their and concern for their lives here in West Virginia. Ours is an incredible nation, and you're going to hear me talk about our military, and if you ask questions about the economy, you hear me talk about our economy, but I want to remind everybody that the true strength of America lies in the hearts and souls of our citizens. That's what America is the greatest. And I appreciate you representing us. I met a woman named Kristen Holloway at the airport. Kristen, where are you? There you go. Gosh, you thought you had a better seat, but nobody was. She came out to say hello. I had a chance to thank her for her being the founder of Operation Troop Appreciation. She has decided to support those who wear a uniform in any way she can. Listen, I understand war is controversial, and I'm going to talk about the war. But America has got to appreciate what it means to wear the uniform today and honor those who have volunteered to keep this country strong. It doesn't matter whether you agree with my decision or not, but all of us should agree with the fact that we have a remarkable country. When people who know that they're going to be sent into harm's way raise their hand and say, I volunteer to serve. And no state has presented had more people volunteering to serve than the great state of West Virginia. Now they'll say, you know, maybe some states have more people, but they got greater populations. But 75% of your National Guard have gone into harm's way. And we appreciate that service, and I want to thank those of you who wear the uniform for your service. I want to thank your loved ones for supporting those who wear the uniform. And I want you to hear loud and clear, the United States of America stands with you. And so appreciate what you're doing. Struck us on September the 11th, 2001. They declared war on the United States of America. And I want to share some lessons about what took place on that day. First of all, I knew that the farther we got away from September the 11th, 2001, the more likely it would be that some would forget the lessons of that day. And that's okay. That's okay. Because the job of those of us who have been entrusted to protect you and defend you is really to do so in such a way that you feel comfortable about going about your life. See? And it's fine that people forget the lessons, but one of my jobs is to constantly remind people of the lessons. The first lesson is that oceans can no longer protect us. You know, when I was coming up in the 50s in Midland, Texas, you know, it seemed like we were pretty safe. In the 60s, it seemed like we're safe. Those conflicts were happening overseas, but we were in pretty good shape here at home. And all that was shattered on that day when cold-blooded killers hijacked airplanes, flew into buildings into the Pentagon and killed 3,000 of our citizens. They declared war, and we have got to take their declaration of war seriously. The most important responsibility of the commander-in-chief and those who wear the uniform and those who are elected to public office is to defend the citizens of this country. That is our most vital and important responsibility. I have never forgotten that from September the 11th on. It's just been a part of my daily existence. Now, secondly, the best way to defend America is to stay on the offense. The best way to protect you is to rally all the strength of national government, intelligence, military, law enforcement, financial strength, to stay on the offense against an enemy that I believe wants to hurt us again. And that means finding where they hide and keep the pressure on. And never relent and understand that you can't negotiate with these folks. There is no compromise. There is no middle ground. And so that's exactly what we're doing. And it's some unbelievably brave troops and intelligence officers working around the clock to keep an enemy that would like to strike us again on the move and to bring him to justice. And we're making progress at dismantling Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, after all, was the enemy that launched the attacks. Second part of a lesson that we must never forget is the enemy in that is they're not a nation state. In other words, they don't represent a nation state like armies and navies used to do. They need safe haven. They need places to hide so they can plan and plot. And they found safe haven, as you all know, in Afghanistan. And they were supported by a government that supports their point of view, which is a government that absolutely can't stand freedom. That was the Taliban. If you were a young girl growing up under the auspices of the Taliban, you didn't have a chance to succeed. You couldn't go to school. If you descended in a public square, you'd be in trouble. If you didn't agree with their dark vision, whether it be religion or politics, you're in trouble. They couldn't stand this concept of a free society. And neither can Al-Qaeda. See, we're dealing with ideologues. They have an ideology. Now, I understand some say, well, maybe they're just isolated. You know, kind of people that are angry. Took out their anger with an attack. That's not how I view them. I view them as people that believe in something. They have an ideological base. They've subverted a great religion to meet their needs. And they need places to hide. And that's why I said early on in the war that if you harbor a terrorist, you're equally as guilty as a terrorist, understanding the nature of the enemy. And understanding they need safe haven. In order to protect ourselves, we must deny them safe haven. By the way, if the president says something, you better mean it for the sake of peace. You want your president out there making sure that his words are credible. And so I said to the Taliban, get rid of Al-Qaeda or face serious consequences. They did, and they faced serious consequences, and we liberated Afghanistan. We removed the Taliban from power. We denied Al-Qaeda safe haven. And that young country, that young democracy, is now beginning to grow. 25 million people are liberated as a result of the United States defending itself. And that's important for us to realize that not only are we defending ourselves, but in this instance, we give a chance to the people to realize the beauties of freedom. There's an interesting debate in the world. It's whether or not freedom is universal. Okay? Whether or not we say, you know, there's old Bush imposing his values. See, I believe freedom is universal. I believe liberty is a universal thought. It's not an American thought. It is a universal thought. And if you believe that, then you ought to take great comfort and joy and helping others realize the benefits of liberty. The way I put it was, there is an Almighty God. One of the greatest gifts of that Almighty God is the desire for people to be free, is freedom. And therefore, this country and the world ought to say, how can we help you remain free? What can we do to help you realize the blessings of liberty? Remember, as we debate these issues, and it's important to have a debate in our democracy, and I welcome the debate, but remember, we were founded on the natural rights of men and women. That speaks to the universality of liberty. We must never forget the origin of our own founding as we look around the world. Afghanistan, I went there with Laura. We had a good visit with President Karzai. I like him. Good man. You know, you can imagine what it's like to try to rebuild a country that had been occupied and then traumatized by the Taliban. They're coming around. They got elections. They had assembly elections. He himself was elected. We expect them to honor the universal principle of freedom. I'm troubled when I hear, deeply troubled when I hear, the fact that a person who is converted away from Islam may be held to account. That's not the universal application of the values that I've talked about. I look forward to working with the government of that country to make sure that people are protected in their capacity to worship. There's still a Taliban element trying to come and hurt people. The good news is not only do we have great U.S. troops there, but NATO is now involved. One of my jobs is to continue to make sure that people understand the benefits of a free society emerging in a neighborhood that needs freedom. So I'm pleased with the progress, but I fully understand there's a lot more work to be done. Another lesson, September the 11th, and an important lesson that really does relate to the topic I want to discuss, which is the Iraq, is that when you see a threat now, you've got to take it seriously. That's the lesson of September the 11th. Another lesson of September 11th. When you see a threat emerging, you just can't hope it goes away. If the job of the president is to protect the American people, my job then is to see threats and deal with them before they fully materialize, before they come to hurt us, before they come and strike America again. And I saw a threat in Iraq. I'll tell you why I saw a threat. And by the way, it just wasn't me. Members of the United States Congress and both political parties saw a threat. My predecessor saw a threat. My predecessor saw a threat, and got the Congress actually to vote a resolution that said we're for regime change. That's prior to my arrival. The world saw a threat. I remember I went to the United Nations Security Council on the 15-0 vote. We passed Resolution 1441 that said that Saddam Hussein disclose, disarm, or face serious consequences. We saw a threat. I'll tell you why I saw a threat. I saw a threat because, one, he had been on the states, he was a state sponsor of terror. There was our government, not when I was president, prior to my presidency, declared Saddam Hussein to be a state sponsor of terror. Secondly, I know for a fact he used weapons of mass destruction. And I thought he had weapons of mass destruction. Members of Congress thought he had weapons of mass destruction. The world thought he had weapons of mass destruction. That's why those nations voted in the Security Council. I find out what went wrong. One of the things you better make sure of is when you're the president, you're getting good intelligence, and obviously the intelligence broke down. But he had that capacity to make weapons of mass destruction as well. He not only murdered his own people, but he used weapons of mass destruction on his own people. That's what we knew prior to the decision I made. He also was firing at our aircraft. They were enforcing a no-fly zone, the United Nations no-fly zone, the world has spoken. And he taken shots at British and U.S. pilots. He had invaded his neighborhood. He said it was a threat. And so the world spoke. And the way I viewed it was that it was Saddam Hussein's choice to disclose, disarm, or face serious consequences. And he made the choice. And then I was confronted with the choice. And I made my choice. And the world is better off without Saddam Hussein in power. The biggest threat America faces is that at a moment when terror and weapons of mass destruction come together. And if we ever suspect that's happening, we've got to deal with that threat seriously. Committing our troops in a harmful way is the most difficult decision a president can make. I'm going to meet with two families of those who lost a loved one. It's my duty to do so. I'm looking forward to being able to hug them, weep with them. And so for anybody out there in West Virginia who thinks it's easy to commit troops, it's hard. It's the last option of the president, not the first option. The first option is to deal with things diplomatically, is to rally the world, to send a clear message that the behavior, in this case of Saddam Hussein, was intolerable. And we did that. Now the fundamental question is, can we win in Iraq? And that's what I want to talk about. First of all, you got to understand, and I fully understand, there's deep concern among the American people about whether or not we can win. And I understand why people are concerned. And they're concerned because the enemy has got the capacity to affect our thinking. This is an enemy who will kill innocent people in order to achieve an objective. And Americans are decent, honorable people. They care. We care about human life. We care about human dignity. We value life. We value the life of our own citizens, and we value the life of other citizens. And so it's easy for an enemy that is willing to kill innocent people to affect us. The enemy has told us their objectives in Iraq. And I think it's important for the commander-in-chief to take the words of the enemy very seriously. They have said that they want to spread their philosophy to other parts of the Middle East. They've said that. They have said they want to attack us again. They believe that democracies are soft. That it's just a matter of time for the United States to lose our will and create a vacuum in Iraq so they can use their terror techniques and their willingness to kill to develop a safe haven from which to launch attacks. That's what the enemy has said. This is I hope the citizens of this country understand that we have intercepted documents and we put them out for people to see. I take the words very seriously. Iraq is a part of the global war on terror. In other words, it's a global war. We're dealing with a group of folks that want to spread an ideology, and they see a problem developing in Iraq, and so they're heading into Iraq to fight us. Because they can't stand the thought of democracy. See? Democracy trumps their ideology every time. Freedom and democracy represent hope. Their point of view represents despair. Freedom represents life and the chance for people to realize their dreams. Their philosophy says you do it my way or else. And so they try to fight us in Iraq. And we have a strategy for victory in Iraq. It's a three-pronged strategy starting with it's politics, it is it's security, and it's economy. On the politics, it was to get the people to the polls to see if they even cared about democracy. Just give them a chance to vote. See what the people thought. And you might remember the elections. It probably seems like an eternity. Just a year ago that they started voting. A little more than a year in January of last year, and the first election winner came off okay, but the Sunnis didn't participate. They were disgruntled with life there. They liked their privileged status, and they were boycotted elections, and they wrote a constitution. It was a good constitution. It's a progressive constitution for that part of the world. More people came out to vote than last December. About 75% of the eligible voters said, I want to be free. I want democracy. I don't care what Mr. Zarqawi and his al-Qaeda killers are trying to do to me. I'm going to defy them and go to the polls. And the people have spoken. And now it's time for government to get stood up. It's time for the elected representatives, or those who represent the voters, the political parties, to come together and form a unity government. That's what the people want. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gone to the polls, would they? I spoke to our ambassador today, General Casey, via video conferencing, and we talked about the need to make it clear to the Iraqis it's time. It's time to get a government in place that can start leading this nation and listen to the will of the people. It's a little hard. You can imagine what it's like coming out of the, having been ruled by a tyrant. Many people were, when we spoke out before, they'll tell them what was going to happen to you. Generally wasn't good. And now people are beginning to realize democracy has taken hold. By the way, if you look at our own history, it's a little bumpy on our road, too. You might remember the Articles of Confederation. They didn't work too well. It took us a while from the moment of our revolution to get our Constitution ready, the one that we now live by. Second part is to help people with their economy, and we had to change our strategy there. We first went in there and said, let's build some big plants. The problem was the big plants served as big targets for those who were disgruntled, the terrorists who were going into Iraq to use it as a safe haven, plus some of their allies, the Saddamists. These were Saddam's inner circle, you know, buddies and stuff like that, that had received special privileges. They weren't happy that they were no longer in privileged status. And so they were destroying some of the infrastructure we were building, so we changed our strategy and said, look, why don't we go with smaller projects, particularly in the provinces, so people can see the benefits of what it means to have a democracy unfold. And the third aspect is security. When we got in there, it became apparent to our troops on the ground that we had a lot of training to do. We had to really rebuild the army to make sure that people had the skills necessary to be able to fight off those who want to stop the march of democracy. First, we trained the army for threats from outside the country. But we realized the true threats were inside the country, whether it be the Saddamists, some Sunni rejectionists, or Al-Qaeda that was in there torturing and killing and maiming in order to get their way. And we're making progress when it comes to training the troops. More and more Iraqis are taking the fight on them. Right after the bombing of the Golden Mosque, for example, is an interesting indication as well about the Iraqi troops are getting better. The enemy can't defeat us militarily, by the way. They can't beat us on the field of battle. But the only thing they can do is they can either try to stop democracy from moving. They failed on that. Last year, they failed. Their stated objective was it's not about democracy going, and they flunked the test. Now they're trying to foment a civil war. That's the only way they can win. And they blew up the mosque. And there was some awful violence. Some reprisals taking place. And I can understand people saying, man, it's all going on. It's not working out. But the security forces did a pretty good job of keeping people apart. In other words, it was a test. It was a test for the security forces, and it was a test for the Iraqi government. Well, I have to put it, they looked into the abyss as to whether they want a civil war or not, and chose not to. That's not to say we don't have more work to do, and we do. But it's important for me to continue. Look, I'm an optimistic guy. I believe we'll succeed. Let me tell you this, put it to you this way. If I didn't think we'd succeed, I'd pull our troops out. I cannot look mothers and dads in the eye. I can't ask this good Marine to go into harm's way if I didn't believe, one, we're going to succeed, and two, it's necessary for the security of the United States. And it's tough fighting. It's tough fighting because we've got an enemy that's just cold-blooded. They can't beat us militarily, but they can try to shake our will. See, remember, I told you, they have said it's just a matter of time. It's a matter of time before the United States loses its nerve. I believe we're doing the right thing, and we're not going to retreat in the face of thugs and assassins. Thank you. It's the Iraqis fight. Ultimately, the Iraqis are going to have to determine their future. They made their decision politically. They voted. And these troops that we're training are going to have to stand up and defend their democracy. We got work, by the way, in 06 to make sure the police are as trained as adequately as the military, the army. Third choice to make. And I like to put it this way. As they stand up, we'll stand down. But I want to say something to you about troop levels, and I know that's something that people are talking about in Washington a lot. I'm going to make up my mind based upon the advice of the United States military that's in Iraq. I'll be making up my mind about the troop levels based upon recommendations of those who are on the ground. I'm going to make up my mind based upon achieving a victory, not based upon polls, focus groups, or election year politics. I was sitting in Tulare the other day in a speech I gave in Cleveland, just real quick. It's an important place. It's a place where, close to the Syrian border, where Al-Qaeda was moving the terrorists from outside the country, inside the country, trying to achieve their objective. And right after we removed Saddam Hussein, they started moving in. And I cannot describe to you how awful these people treat the citizens there. I mean, they are... I told a story about a young boy who was maimed, taken to the hospital, was pulled out of the hospital, was killed by those terrorists. His dad went to retrieve him on the side of the road, and they put a bomb underneath him and blew up the family. I mean, Americans cannot understand the nature of how brutal these people are. It's shocking what they will do to try to achieve their objectives. But it really shouldn't shock us when you think about what they did on September the 11th. It's the same folks, same attitude, same frame of mind. But they're able to lock down cities, particularly those that are worried about their security. And so they basically took control of Tulare. So our troops went in with Iraqis and cleaned it out. The problem was, oh, not through yet. A little early on the clamp. The problem was, we would continue to pursue the enemy and then move back in. These killers, murderers, move back in and just created a mess. I mean, I said in my speech, they mortared the children in a playground. They recruited young kids, abused them, violated them. There's one boy in particular who told our guys, once the city eventually got liberated, you know, his dream was to behead somebody when he under... Anyway. We started working with the local folks again. This time, though, we had trained more Iraqi army ready to go. And the difference in the story between the first time we liberated Tulare from them and the recent liberation was that the Iraqis were in the lead. And not only were they in the lead, they stayed behind after we left. So our troops are chasing high-value targets and training, and capable Iraqi forces are providing security. And so the day of terror began to change when they saw capable forces and a new mayor and police forces. I mean, it's hard to put ourselves in the shoes of the folks in this town that had been traumatized. But the strategy of clear, hold, and build began to create a sense of confidence. And what's interesting, and I can say that, I got one data point that I share with you, the vote... In the January 05 election was the second lowest vote as percentage of voting population in the country. And the last vote, 85% of the eligible voters voted. Those people had a sense of security and hope. A free Iraq is important for the United States of America. It was important to remove a threat. It was important to deal with threats before they fully materialized. You know, people were able to take advantage of that, these totalitarians like Al-Qaeda. So I changed our foreign policy. I said freedom is universal. History has proven democracies do not fight each other. Democracies can yield peace we want. So let's advance freedom. And that's what's happening. It's a big idea that... It's a big idea, but it's an old idea. It's worked in the past. I strongly believe that by promoting liberty, we're not only protecting ourselves, but we're laying the foundation of peace for a generation to come. And I'll tell you why I believe that, and then I'll answer questions. Thank goodness Laura in here, she could give me the, you know, the hook. The two examples I use that are, you know, obviously, I'm living one example, and that is my relationship with the Prime Minister of Japan. He is one of my best buddies. I don't know if you're supposed to call them buddies in diplomacy, right? But anyway, one of my best buddies in working to keep the peace. I find that a really interesting statement to say to you, knowing my own family's history. 18-year-old, my dad, when he was 18, went to fight the Japanese. I think it's really one of the interesting twists of history that I stand here in West Virginia saying to you that Prime Minister Koizumi and I talk about ways to keep the peace, ways to deal with North Korea, he's helping in Iraq, ways to deal with other issues. And 60 years prior to that, when the country called, George H.W. said, I want to go, just like I'm sure relatives of you all. And Japan was the sworn enemy. And there were a lot of bloodshed in order to, remember, they attacked us too. And yet today, the president says, we're working to keep the peace. And what happened? It's an interesting lesson that I hope people remember. Something happened. What happened was Japan adopted a Japanese-style democracy. I believe freedom and liberty can change enemies into allies. I believe freedom has the power to transform societies. It's not easy work. It's difficult work. But we've seen history before. I know you've got relatives who were in World War II. On that continent, hundreds of thousands of Americans lost their lives in two world wars during the 1900s. And yet today, Europe is whole, free, and at peace. What happened? Democracies don't war. And so part of my decision-making that I'm trying to explain to you today about war, about what you're seeing on your TV screens, about the anxiety that a lot of our citizens feel, is based upon, one, the need to protect the American people. And my deep reservoir of commitment to doing what it takes, to look at the world realistically, to understand we're in a global war against a serious enemy. But also my thinking is based upon some universal values and my belief that history can repeat itself, and that freedom and liberty has a chance to lay a foundation of peace, so that maybe 40 years from now, somebody is speaking here in West Virginia saying, you know, a bunch of folks were given a challenge and a task, and that generation didn't lose faith in the capacity of freedom to change. And today I'm able to sit down with the duly elected leaders of democracy in the Middle East, keeping the peace for the next generation to come. That's what I've come to talk to you about. And that's what's on my mind. And I'll be glad to answer any questions you got. Yes, sir. First man up.
Mr. President, I'm going to make your job a little easier.
Okay.
To sum it all up, what you're trying to say is when it comes to fighting terrorism, there is no easy button.
Thank you, sir. I'll be glad to answer any question on any subject. I always appreciate a good editorial. Yes, sir. Hold on a second. We're going to do a little oracle here. Right here. Right there. Yeah, there you go. Get moving on the mic, please. Tell me what happens if I don't have a mic. The guy yells a question. I just answer whatever I want to answer.
Mr. President, I have a son that's Special Forces in Iraq, and I have another son. I have another son that's in the Army. He left college to join the Army. He's out in Hawaii. He's got the good duty right now. But I thank God that you're our Commander-in-Chief, and I wouldn't want my voice. Commander-in-Chief, you're a man for our times, and I'm a supporter of yours, and I think it's good that you come out and tell your story, and I think you need to keep doing more of it and tell the story and the history of all this, and God bless you.
I appreciate you saying that. A couple of points. First, you tell your kids science. The good news is for moms and dads and husbands and wives and children, that in spite of the debate you've seen in Washington, that there is a commitment to support our troops when they're in harm's way. There may be an argument about tactics and whether or not they should have done it in the first place. I understand that. But the Congress has stood up, and that's what Congress should do. And take comfort, please, in knowing that the debates that you're seeing will not lessen our government's support for making sure the people are well-trained, well-paid, well-equipped, well-housed. We owe that. And I'm pleased with the congressional response to supporting troops. If I can email them, it's an interesting war we have where moms and dads and wives and husbands are in touch with their loved ones by email. It's really interesting. And I want to thank you very much for saying what you said. As I said, I'm Educator-in-Chief, and I'm going to spend a lot of time answering questions and just explaining to people as clearly as I can about why I make decisions I made and why it is important for us to succeed. And again, I understand a debate. I understand there's differences of opinion, and we should welcome that in America. People should never fear a difference of opinion, particularly on big matters. And war is a big matter, war and peace. And it's healthy for our country for people to be debating, so long as we don't send the wrong signals to our troops, so long as they don't think that that we're not behind them, and so long as we don't send mixed signals to the enemy. The enemy believes that we will weaken and lose our nerve. And I just got to tell you, I'm not weak and I'm not going to lose my nerve. I strongly believe.
You
want to
say something, Joe?
Yeah. How about the gov?
Make it easy.
Yeah. I appreciate Joe talked to me about how do we use the natural resources of the state of West Virginia in such ways to become less dependent on oil. Now, let me talk about that. Starting with coal gasification leading to coal liquefaction. I appreciate the subject. I know it shocked some of you. I know it shocked some of you when I stood up in the State of the Union and said, we got a problem, we're addicted to oil. Texas, you know that. Tell you why I said it. I'll tell you why I said it. One, because when the demand for fossil fuels goes up, for non-renewable resources goes up in other parts of the world, it affects the gasoline price here at home. See, when somebody else's economy starts to boom and they start using more fossil fuel, it affects your price, too. It's important for people to understand. And there are some new economies emerging that are growing and that are using a lot of hydrocarbons. Secondly, we get oil from parts of the world that don't like us, is the best way to put it, which creates a national security issue. And therefore, it is in our economic interest and national interest that we get off of our additional oil. We import about 67% of our oil from overseas. What Joe's talking about is a different use of resources to help us achieve that objective. First thing is, we got a lot of coal, 250-year supply of coal, which helps us on our electricity. And we're spending a lot of money on clean coal technology. The whole idea is to use taxpayers' money to develop a technology that enables us to have zero-emission plants, which will help us achieve an environmental objective as well as an energy independence objective. Joe's talking about spending research money on the gasification of coal, which then will lead to the liquefaction, which we're able to develop a product that way. And I believe we ought to attack this issue on all fronts, on a variety of fronts. I know we ought to use nuclear power. It is a renewable source of energy that has got zero greenhouse gas effect. By the way, I went to a plant that's making solar plant panels, photovoltaic cells. You know? Not bad for a history major. Technologies are coming, and to me it makes sense to work with Congress to spend money on new technologies aiming for a national objective. The place where we're really going to affect reliance upon oil is changing our automobile, how automobiles are powered. One is battery technologies are coming around. One of these days, I'm told, that if we continue to stay focused and research, you're going to be able to have a pretty good-sized vehicle, plug it in, and it'll be able to drive 40 miles before you need to use any gasoline in your engine. Now, that's not going to help some of your rural folks in West Virginia or Texas, but it's going to help urban people who generally tend not to drive more than 40 miles a day. But imagine if we're able to have battery power where you plug your battery into when the electricity is down, you know, low usage at night, and they drive 40 miles. That'll reduce the demand for gasoline, which reduces the demand for crude oil. Secondly, we're going to be able to drive our cars based upon with a sugar base or a corn base or a, you know, sawgrass. I said that when I said, what the heck is sawgrass, you know? It's just grass. It just grows out there and you all get formed. And the idea is to develop technology so that we're using more ethanol. It's happening in the Midwest, by the way. They've got what they call E85. That's 85% ethanol that's powering automobiles now. A whole new industry is beginning to grow. And the more we use alternative sources of energy, the less dependent we are on oil. So Joe's always thinking. And he's a practical fella, which is sometimes not the case in government. But what he's saying is, can't we use our resources here in a way, Mr. President, it helps you achieve a grand national objective, which is getting off Middle Eastern oil? Let me ask you, yes, we can. Yeah, you got a question? Are you in school?
Yeah.
Then do you use me as an excuse to skip school?
Of course. Mr. President, I was wondering, actually, how you felt about America's double standard on nuclear energy as far as countries like Iran, India, and Israel go.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I may ask you to clarify your question of double standard.
Well, how we don't allow Iran to have nuclear energy, yet we're supporting India.
Yeah, no, I got it. I wouldn't necessarily, well, first of all, let me explain the policy, and then you can draw whatever conclusion you want. First of all, it's in our interests that India use nuclear power to power their economic growth, because, as I told you, there is a global connection between demand for fossil fuels elsewhere and price here. So I went to India and I said, actually it's a very sophisticated question, by the way, but I said, we ought to encourage you to use nuclear power. Now, what's the difficulty with that issue, and the Congress is going to have to deal with, is that India has heretofore been denied technologies from the United States because of previous decisions they made about nuclear weaponry. My attitude is that over 30 years, they have proven themselves to be a non-proliferator, that they're a transparent democracy. It's in our interest that they develop nuclear power to help their economy grow. They need power, they need energy to do so. And they're willing to go under the safeguards of the IAEA, which is an international forum, to make sure that there are certain safeguards. Iran. The Iranians are a non-transparent society, certainly not a democracy. They are sponsors of terrorism. They have joined the IAEA, and yet we caught them cheating. In other words, they weren't upholding the agreements, and they started to try to enrich uranium in order to develop a weapons program. India is heading to the IAEA. The Iranians are ignoring IAEA. And so to answer your question about potential conflict of civilian energy power, I have said that I support the Russian proposal that says the Iranians should have a civilian nuclear industry. However, Russia and other suppliers would give them the enriched, the product, necessarily the power in their industry, and collect the spent fuel, but not enable the Iranians to learn how to enrich in order to develop a weapons program. That's, I think I will go on a second. That's how we addressed the inconsistency on the power side, the apparent inconsistency. However, in that the Iranians are non-transparent, in that they are hostile to the United States, hostile to allies, we got to be very careful about not letting them develop a weapon. And so we're now dealing with this issue diplomatically by having the Germans and the French and the British send a clear message to the Iranians with our strong backing that you will not have the capacity to make a weapon, to know how to make a weapon. Iran, with a nuclear weapon, is a threat and it's dangerous. And we must not let them have a weapon. Yeah.
Sir, thank you for being in West Virginia. I'm the recruiting commander of the West Virginia Army National Guard. And there are a lot of National Guardsmen here with you and willing today. West Virginians are proud and very patriotic people. I'd like for you to share with us what you would say to a young person today who would like to join the National Guard, and maybe give some encouraging words in that respect.
Okay, thanks. Kind of doing your job for you, all right? My statement to all Americans is serve your country one way or another. And service can be done by wearing a uniform. Wearing a uniform is a fantastic way to say I want to serve my country. A lot of people have chosen that way, and it's a rewarding experience to wear the uniform. If you want to go to college, it's a good way to gain some skills to help you in your education. There are also other ways to serve. You can mentor a child and you're serving America. You can help the Katrina victims and you're serving America. You can be a Boy Scout troop leader and you're serving America. What's really interesting about our country, and I said this early on, is the notion of people coming together to serve a concept greater than themselves. I know it's not unique to America, but it certainly helps define our spirit. De Tocqueville, who's a French guy, came in 1832s and recognized and wrote a treatise about what it means to go to a country where people associate voluntarily. to serve their communities. And he recognized it as, you know, one of the great strengths of America. It's the 1830s. It is still a strength of America. It is, you know, it is a vital part of our societies and our communities. The idea of people volunteering to help a neighbor in need. And one of my jobs is to honor people who are serving our country that way, and to call other people to service as well. It says, you know, one of the interesting and at times controversial proposals was whether or not government should open up grant money for competitive bidding for faith-based organizations. I'm a big believer in providing grant money available for faith-based organizations, so long as the money doesn't go used to proselytize, but is used to help serve a purpose. Like if you're a mother or dad is in prison, that would help to go find a mentor for that child. Or if you're a drug addict, or got hooked on alcohol, that you could redeem the government help at a faith-based institution. In other words, we in government ought to be asking the question, does the program work? And a lot of times, programs based upon faith do work. That it is, it's nothing better than a faith-based program which exists to love a neighbor like you like to be loved yourself. And therefore, part of my job is to not only help recruit the guard, plug in there for you, there you go, but also to call people to serve, to help change our society one person at a time. And it's happening. It's a remarkable part of the confidence of this community, just like it is all around the United States. And thanks for the question. Yes, sir. Yep. The guy in the yellow hat, give it to the guy now. No, you're not a guy. right behind you. There you go.
President Bush. I'm a professional firefighter here in Wheeling, West Virginia.
Thank you, sir.
And back during 9/11, I lost over 300 of my brothers in New York, and I was glad that you were a president at that time and took the fight to the terrorists. But as I see you said earlier about the guy in Afghanistan that is going to convert to Christianity, he may get killed over there for doing that. Do you have an army of sociologists to go over there and change that country, or are you hoping that in a couple decades that we can change the mindset over there?
I appreciate the question. It's a very legitimate question. We have got influence in Afghanistan, and we are going to use it to remind them that there are universal values. It is deeply troubling that a country we helped liberate would hold a person to account because they chose a particular religion over another. And so we will make our part of the messaging just happen here in Wheeling. I want to thank you for that question. No, I think it's we can solve this problem by working closely with the government that we've got contacts with, and we'll deal with this issue diplomatically and remind people that there is something as universal as being able to choose religions. Thank you for the question. I understand your concerns. I share the same concerns. I have a little guy back here. Yes, sir. Do I like living in the White House? Yeah. That's a good, fair question. Well, your brother's got one too. You want to back to back them? Okay. Well, I've been the president for 5.5 years. I do like living in the White House. It's an interesting question. For some practical reasons, I've got a 45-second commute to my office. Food's pretty good. It is a I've enjoyed every second of the presidency. That's probably hard. My buddies, you know, come from up from Texas. One of the things that Laura and I are most proud of, and we're most proud of our girls, but we're also very proud of the fact that we had friends prior to being in politics from Texas that'll be our friends after we're in politics. And and they come up from Texas and they're kind of looking at you like, man, are you okay? Yeah. And I tell them, I said, you know, I can't tell you what an honor it is to do this job. They often ask, what's the job description? I said, making decisions. And I make a lot. Obviously, I'm trying to share with you, you know, you may not agree with the decision, but at the very minimum, I want you to understand that I make my decisions based upon some principles I hold dear. In order to make decisions, you have to be enthusiastic about your job. You have to be optimistic about the future. You have to stand for something. You can't be a president trying to search for what you believe in the midst of all the noise in Washington. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. No, right here. Good. There you go.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. It is an honor to be here today. Thank you for coming. Greetings from Columbus, Ohio.
There you go.
Actually,
my grandfather was raised in Columbus, Ohio. Not to change subjects. Prescott S. Bush.
I have a comment, first of all, and then just a real quick question. I want to let you know that every service at our church, you are by name lifted up in prayer, and you and your staff and all of our leaders, and we believe in you, we are behind you, and we cannot thank you enough for what you've done to shape our country. Thank you. This is my husband who has returned from a 13-month tour into credit.
Thank you, man. Welcome back.
His job while serving was as a broadcast journalist, and he has brought back several DVDs full of wonderful footage of reconstruction, of medical things going on. And I ask you this from the bottom of my heart for a solution to this, because it seems that our major media networks don't want to portray the good. They just want to
okay, hold on a second.
They just want to focus on another car bomb, or they just want to focus on some more bloodshed, or they just want to focus on how they don't agree with you and what you're doing when they don't even probably know how you're doing what you're doing anyway. But what can we do to get that footage on CNN, on Fox, to get it on headline news, to get it on the local news, because you can send it to the news people, and I'm sorry I'm rambling, like I have,
so
saying, can we use this? And it will just end up in a drawer, because it's good, it portrays the good, and if people could see that, if the American people could see it, there would never be another negative word about this conflict.
Well, I appreciate that. So I come out and speak. I spoke in Cleveland, gave a press conference yesterday. I spoke in Cleveland Monday, press conference here today. I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing. Just try to make sure people can hear there's, you know, why I make decisions, and as best as I can explain why I'm optimistic we can succeed. One of the things that we've got to value is the fact that we do have a media, a free media, that's able to do what they want to do. And I'm not going to, you know, you're asking me to say something in front of all the cameras. Help over there, yeah, you know. I just got to keep talking. And one of the word of mouth, there's blogs, there's the internet, there's all kinds of ways to communicate, which is literally changing the way people are getting their information. And And so if you're concerned, I would suggest that you reach out to some of the groups that are supporting the troops that have got internet sites, and just keep the word moving. And that's one way to deal with an issue without suppressing a free press. We will never do that in America. I mean, if the minute we start trying to suppress our press, we look like the Taliban. The minute we start telling people how to worship, we look like the Taliban, and we're not interested in that in America. We're the opposite. We believe in freedom, and we believe in freedom in all its forms. And obviously, I know you're frustrated with what you're seeing, but there are ways in this new kind of age and being able to communicate that you'll be able to, you know, spread the message that you want to spread. Thank you for your concerns, and thank you for your prayer. I want to tell you something interesting about the job of president. Frankly, I didn't anticipate this part of the presidency, but it's an amazing part of my job to know that millions of people pray for me. It really is. Think about that. You know, strangers stand up and say in front of 3,000 people, "I'm praying for you," and it helps. And I appreciate it. I'm going to thank you for your prayers. It helps do the job. It helps keep perspective. Yes, sir.
I'm a senior at the local high school, Willing Park High School, and I just want to know what your views are on what type of America my generation will be.
Yeah, interesting question. First, I hope that your generation will leave. No doubt your generation will leave. Generations when called somehow find the courage to lead. That's step one. Two, I think you'll be dealing in a world in which you will be confronted with making values choices. For example, family. Materialized, science trunk. Morality, as some see it. You'll be confronted, hopefully, with a world that has been able to be free enough so that this war that's going on now has kind of faded out. This war is not going to stop like that. You know, it's not gonna, like we'll have a signing ceremony somewhere. But it's a matter of marginalizing those who espouse violence and empowering those who love freedom. Now, you'll be confronted with a world in which, we're seeing a little bit of it now in America, whether or not we will be bold and confident in our economic policy to shape the future, or we'll be worried about competition and retreat within our borders. It's an interesting debate. My attitude is, as I said in the State of the Union, we cannot become an isolationist nation. But you'll be confronted with making that decision. If we're an isolationist nation, it means we'll just say, don't worry about them over there. Let them deal with it themselves. If it's an isolationist nation, we won't worry about HIV/AIDS on the continent of Africa, which we should worry about. See, I believe to whom much is given, much is required, and that we have an obligation not only to help our folks here at home, but also to help save lives elsewhere. And you'll be confronted with that decision. You'll be confronted with a decision as to whether or not we can confidently compete against nations like India and China on the economic front. And it'll be an interesting challenge. We're facing that challenge somewhat now. My judgment, this is the beginning of what will be a constant set of decisions that future generations are going to have to make. You'll be confronted with privacy issues, privacy on the internet, privacy in electronic medical records that I think ought to happen, but you want, in order to make sure we save costs of medicine. But you'll be confronted with making sure that this new technologies that we're going to use to help improve, for example, the information of medicine, that it doesn't encroach into your private business, into your life. That'll be a confrontation that you'll have to deal with. Anyway, you'll be confronted with some stuff. Hopefully our job is to make sure you're confronted with less issues, like being hooked on oil, One of the issues that we're confronting with now that I hope you not have to confront with is jobs going elsewhere because we don't have the math and science skills and engineering skills and physics skills that talk to our children here. One of the really interesting challenges we have is to make sure not only the education of our children is focused on literacy, but there's literacy in math and science and physics and chemistry, where the jobs of the 21st century, the skills necessary for the jobs of the 21st century, hopefully we'll have them dealt with that. Otherwise, you're going to be confronted with playing catch-up. And that's why it's important for us to get that job done. You're going to be confronted with, unless we act now, a Social Security system and a Medicare system that's gone broke. And I want to talk about that right quick. And I thought about it. I think about it a lot. I see what's coming down the road. A lot of baby boomers like me turned 60 this year, and I'll be retirement age in 2 years, 2008. Kind of convenient, isn't it? And a lot of people like me, a whole lot of baby boomers. It's one of those statistical facts that people got to pay attention to. And interestingly enough, my generation has been promised more benefits than the previous generation. People are running for office and vote for me and we'll make sure this next generation gets a better deal than the previous generation. Because there's a lot of folks like me being promised greater benefits who are living longer. I don't have plans. The other 60-year-olds, how long they plan to live, I plan on kind of stretching her out, And there's fewer people paying the system for beneficiary. And so we have a problem coming. The system's going to go broke. And I addressed the issue last year, and I'm going to address the issue again, and again, and again. So call Congress to the table. My strategy last time was to go around the country and explain the problem on the belief that once the people heard there was a problem, they would then demand the representative to do something about the problem. It didn't work. There was no legislation last year. So I got another idea. And that is, we're going to set up a group of members of Congress from both parties, both chambers, recognizing that nothing can get done on this issue unless it's a bipartisan issue. And say, now's the time. That's what we're here for. We have been elected to confront problems and deal with them. That's what the people expect. And they're tired, by the way, of all the politics in Washington, D.C. They expect people to come together, to sit down at the table, and to solve this problem so you don't have to deal with it. All right. Last question, and I got to go back to work. This didn't work. for a minute, please. I can't stand. Okay, two questions. Who yelled the loudest? You did? All right, go ahead. Then you're your last guy. You're next to last. You're last.
Mr. President, thank you again for coming. My question, I believe that one of our greatest resources is our self-sufficiency. And as you drive down the road, you'll see that our community is dying because of the importation of cheap steel. I'd like to know what your plans are to help alleviate this.
Well, as you know, right after I got elected, I put a 201 in place. And that was our way of providing breathing space so that the firm can adjust. And I fully understand the problems that the steel mills are going through here. The governor spent a lot of time briefing me on that on the way in, as did Shelley Moore. And it's obviously, it's going to require good energy policy. Your plan can exist if it's got decent energy and reliable supplies at reasonable prices. Your plan can exist if you've got reasonable health care costs. That's why it's important for us to do a variety of measures to help reduce the cost of health care. I just mentioned one in information technology, and another is to get rid of these junk lawsuits that run up the cost of medicine. In order for you to be competitive, we got to make sure that products are treated fairly. As you know, I'm a free trader, but I also believe that people ought to treat the United States the way we treat them. If we let products come in here, they ought to let our products in on the same basis, I believe. So I'm aware of the issue you brought up, and thank you for bringing it up. It's a little guy. Got to head back home, hope you understand, otherwise we'd be here all day. Wouldn't mind being here all day, but I got something else to do. Better go.
Mr. President, I want to say it's a privilege and a blessing to be here with you.
Thank you.
And thank you for having integrity since you've been in office. My name is Michael Dunnell. I'm a statewide field director for the campaign for Hiram Lewis for U.S. Senate. And as you close, I appreciate what you had stated earlier about politicians. And as you close today, I did 2 years of volunteer work for the Republican Party while I worked a full-time job. It paid off for me in this position now. And I see folks that are increasingly discouraged with the status quo because the difference.
There's no campaign speeches.
No, sir. I'm not.
Okay.
My only question is, what would you say to those, whether Democrat or Republican? How could you encourage those that are dissatisfied with the status
quo? I appreciate that. Look, it is really important for people to at least trust the decision making process of those of us in public office. You may not agree with the decisions. You may not, and look, I understand a lot of people don't agree, and that's fine. That's fine. But they got to understand, at least in my case, that I'm making my decisions based upon what I think is right. And that making decisions that of the kind that I make, for example, got to be based upon a set of principles that won't change. People got to understand that. When there's any doubt about the integrity of the public servant, like in Washington has been recently, they got to clean it. They got to work to clean it up. There got to be lobby reform in this case. I mean, the truth of the matter is, a couple of members of the House of Representatives disgraced the process. The person took money in order to put things in appropriations bills. That's unacceptable in our democracy. And it needs to be dealt with in order to be able to earn the confidence of the people. I worry about lack of voter participation. I'm concerned that people don't participate at the ballot box. And it's something that we've all got to work on, because democracy is really depends upon the participation of our citizenry. It's really important for high school students, and one of the challenges you'll face is whether or not our democracy is able to continue to get people to say, I can make a difference in the ballot box. And so to answer your question, integrity is essential part of the process. Integrity in decision making, integrity in how we deal with the people's money, integrity of and part of a system based upon integrity is one that deals with like in this case an ethical behavior very quickly with certainty, so that people have got confidence in the system. I appreciate you working in the process. I want to thank you for your question. I wish I could stay longer to answer your questions. I can't. I got to go back to D.C. I'm not necessarily saying I'd rather be in D.C. than here. I'd rather be here than there, but nevertheless, that's what my life dictates. God bless you all.